from WNYC in New York. This is a special podcast edition of On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
Good evening, and the fallout continues tonight from the release of the so-called CIA torture report that all the world has now been allowed to see.
This document, more than 500 pages long, details the mistreatment of prisoners after 9/11, claims the agency misled the public and the press.
2009, and it shows that torture carried out by the CIA was far more brutal, far more widespread, and on far shakier legal ground than the agency had previously represented.
The Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA torture and the lies surrounding it was released Tuesday. It was graphic and horrifying in its unvarnished depiction of medieval abuses and in the knowledge that all of it was conducted by our government in our name in zealous defense of our sacred freedom.
Waterboarding, near drowning, slamming people against the wall, hanging them in stress positions, confining them in small boxes or coffins, threatening them with drills, waving guns around their head as they are blindfolded.
NBC's Andrea Mitchell to CIA Director John Brennan on Thursday, citing the menu of depravity. She did not mention the technique called rectal rehydration, which sounds like a New Age therapy, but isn't. The report, in all its sickening detail, yielded the inevitable disgust and the inevitable partisan objections. Senate Republicans, who refused to participate in the report's preparations, criticized the summary of 5 years' investigation as a Democratic smear. Senate Minority Leader and soon-to-be Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, quote, "This is the Democrats' only report. It served no purpose other than to confirm what we already knew, that certain techniques were used on a few people." Former Vice President Dick Cheney, the inquisitor-in-chief who had personally signed off on the torture policy, went on a media no-apology tour to deny, without evidence, the nauseating Senate finding that the torture failed even to produce useful intelligence.
"We did exactly what needed to be done in order to catch those who were guilty on 9/11 and to prevent a further attack. And we were successful on both parts."
"This
and
report says it was not successful."
"The report's full of crap, excuse me. I said hooey yesterday. Let me use the real word."
On another show, Fox host Andrea Tantaros, well, I won't characterize what she said because it's like describing the sunset. Words are insufficient.
"And look, I agree with you. The United States of America is awesome. We are awesome. But we've had this discussion. We've closed the book on it and we've stopped doing it. And the reason they want to have this discussion is not to show how awesome we are. This administration wants to have this discussion to show us how we're not awesome."
That insight, of course, comes courtesy of a cable channel friendly to the Bush-Cheney administration and openly hostile to Democrats. One of the more disturbing aspects of the Senate report is how the so-called liberal media, against which Fox defines itself, were co-opted themselves with phony claims that they uncritically passed along. The scheme offered eerie echoes of Judith Miller, Dick Cheney, and phantom weapons of mass destruction, the strategic leak love triangle that helped justify a ruinous invasion of Iraq. From the report, quote, "The CIA's Office of Public Affairs and senior CIA officials coordinated to share classified information on the CIA's detention and interrogation program to select members of the media to counter public criticism, shape public opinion, and avoid potential congressional action to restrict the CIA's detention and interrogation authorities and budget."
"If the CIA and the other American intelligence agencies, after 4 years of turmoil, are they better or worse? Tonight, I'll take you to the highest echelons and deep inside the war on terror."
That was Tom Brokaw anchoring NBC's June 2005 special, The Long War. Concurrent with the broadcast, according to the Senate report, the network published an online article citing anonymous intelligence sources attributing the capture of 9/11 plotter Khalid Sheikh Mohammed ultimately to information gleaned in the waterboarding of detainee Abu Zubaydah. A year later, a New York Times piece quoted an anonymous CIA source who claimed, after the waterboarding of Zubaydah commenced, quote, "he soon began to provide information on key al-Qaeda operators to help us find and capture those responsible for the 9/11 attacks." Except, the Senate report says, it simply isn't true. CIA received its actionable intelligence from an informant within al-Qaeda, motivated not by torture, but by cash money. That nugget, weirdly, was also reported by Brokaw in his 2005 special. Two contradictory explanations, and NBC reported both. According to the Intelligence Committee, such discrepancies abound, including concoctions made not merely for the media, but for the Congress, the FBI, and even the Bush White House itself. Matt Apuzzo is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at the New York Times. On Tuesday, he examined eight cases cited in the so-called torture report where the CIA said its torture tactics thwarted plots and led to the capture of terrorists, but which claims were debunked by the committee. Matt, welcome back to OTM.
Great to be here.
Let's just go down the list of the intelligence triumphs claimed by the CIA and the debunking according to the report. And we may as well begin with the killing of Osama bin Laden. Here's Republican Congressman Peter King on Fox's The O'Reilly Factor in 2011.
We got vital information which directly led us to bin Laden.
Wow.
It was during the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed through waterboarding.
The whole hunt for Osama bin Laden really boils down to a hunt for his courier, a guy by the name of Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti. The story has been out there that the black site interrogations were what finally led the CIA to al-Kuwaiti and thus led them to bin Laden's door. But the committee's report shows that as early as 2002, the CIA had a wealth of information about this courier. They knew his alias, they knew how close he was with bin Laden, they had a physical description of him, and that the CIA was wiretapping a phone number associated with him and was monitoring an email address associated with him. They had recordings of his voice. So the committee is saying the idea that you needed harsh interrogation to get onto the courier is wrong. The real linchpin in the hunt for bin Laden is this detainee named Hassan Ghul, who was subject to harsh interrogation. But the committee says that Hassan Ghul was cooperative right from the beginning, as soon as he was captured. One of the documents cited in the report says that he, quote, sang like a Tweety bird, and that he expansively discussed the courier, described him as bin Laden's closest assistant, and basically laid the groundwork for catching al-Kuwaiti.
Sang like a Tweety bird without being tortured.
Correct, just having a conversation.
Another high-profile case concerned Jose Padilla, the American who was accused of a plot to plant a dirty bomb. This is ex-CIA agent John Kiriakou on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360 in 2007.
With Abu Zubaydah, they worked very well, and we were able to corroborate the information that he provided after the waterboarding, and it turned out to be accurate.
The committee says not so fast.
The Padilla case is really interesting because when this came out in 2002, it was just this terrifying prospect. Here was an American who was accused of plotting a radiological dirty bomb attack inside the United States, and it has since come out that the CIA credited the interrogation of its first high-value detainee, Abu Zubaydah, with uncovering this plot and leading the CIA and the FBI to Jose Padilla in the United States. His arrest has been held up for years as proof that waterboarding and these tactics work. What is frankly really interesting about the report's take on Jose Padilla is that Abu Zubaydah's information on Jose Padilla and this plot was really sketchy, and that he provided it well before he was waterboarded. In fact, Jose Padilla was arrested by the FBI in May 2002. That's 3 months before the CIA's interrogation of Abu Zubaydah began. So the committee says, hey, you already arrested this guy and knew that he was planning this plot even before you waterboarded Abu Zubaydah. What's super interesting about the committee's report is it shows that a lot of people in the CIA didn't even take this plot seriously. Apparently, and this is the first I'd heard of this, this plot involved putting uranium in a bucket and swinging it over your head on a pole for 45 minutes. And the CIA analyst determined that this would, I believe the quote was, would definitely not result in a nuclear explosive device, but would definitely kill you. Like, Jose Padilla definitely would have died, and nothing else would have happened.
There were a couple of plots that were foiled, that the CIA attributes to information gleaned in the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that again, and it becomes like a broken record, the committee concludes pre-existed the, right. the torture itself. They had the information.
Right.
Tell me about these two plots
sure.
that supposedly were thwarted with evidence gathered through waterboarding.
Right. So I'd like to focus on the biggie, what's become known as the second wave plot. So in 2006, the White House announced that there had been a plot that immediately followed 9/11 in which Malaysian hijackers were going to use a shoe bomb to hijack an airplane and fly it into the tallest building in Los Angeles. The CIA credited the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed with uncovering the second wave plot. But the committee report says that the CIA learned about the plot in January 2002 with the arrest of the ringleader, a guy by the name of Mazran bin Arshad, before Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was captured, before he was waterboarded. And they said, that's how you thwarted the plot, by capturing the Malaysian at the center of the whole thing. So the CIA has responded and said, look, it was wrong for us to say we learned about the plot through the waterboarding. What we should have said is that we got additional information after using these enhanced interrogation on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others. So it does seem to be a situation where the CIA said, look, we used imprecise language, but we still think we got good information from enhanced interrogation that helped us unravel this plot.
Let me play the devil's advocate here for a moment, Matt. Presuming society agrees that torture is acceptable in the so-called ticking bomb scenario, where many, many lives are at stake, it becomes morally acceptable to torture. Let's just say. And let's just say that all of these scenarios as described in the report qualify under the ticking bomb scenario. Let's just say. We did learn through 9/11 that just being in possession of information does not necessarily get the government springing into action. It doesn't necessarily get its various agencies sharing information to act on what it already knows. Is it possible that just the corroboration of previously gathered evidence gleaned from this torture spurred the intelligence community to do exactly what it says it did, act to prevent large-scale terrorist attacks that could have killed many people? Is it possible that absent the intelligence gleaned from torture, the other intelligence would have just sort of languished there as it did before 9/11, unacted upon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why it's so important that we study this stuff and see this report not as a accusation or that something needs to be defended against, but to try to go through it and really read the footnotes. And frankly, I hope we can get a full declassified version at some point. This is a historic document that really serves as a chronology of this unprecedented moment in our history. It's absolutely possible that some of this information was corroborative and helped the CIA. And frankly, I don't think the people who did the investigation for the Senate are going to get up and say the CIA got no information from this. They're saying nothing in this directly thwarted or was essential to the thwarting of plots. But sure, obviously, the information was gleaned from the interrogations.
Is there any benefit to the political right saying the left have just manufactured a kangaroo court case against the Bush administration and the left saying that the political right are liars and apologists for torture?
I suppose there's always a benefit to a vigorous debate on this, but I'm hopeful that as really smart people spend a lot of time with the report and that we learn a lot about our history from this beyond you did this and you should have done that and you're bad. One of the things that is clear from this report is the CIA after 9/11 was faced with this huge challenge of preventing another terrorist attack and basically reinvented itself overnight. And that when they started out, they never planned on having prisons and using these tactics. They wanted to do a prison system that followed U.S. prison laws or U.S. law of war detention. And as sort of time progressed, that just sort of fell away. And I think it's important for us to understand how that happens.
Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Apuzzo is a reporter for the New York Times. For the record, on Thursday, the CIA denied willfully misrepresenting anything to the American people. In June 2009, I spoke to then NPR ombudsman Alicia Shepard, who had supported the network's then practice of declining to explicitly identify waterboarding and other CIA tactics as torture. I put it to you that embracing a euphemism for torture validates a political position. You're trying to be apolitical, but in fact, to embrace terms like harsh interrogation tactics instead of calling a thing by its name, in effect, gives credence to the Bush administration's argument, does it not?
Yes, I think it does. I think using terms like harsh interrogation tactics or enhanced interrogation techniques does validate the Bush administration. So that's why I said, why not just describe it? I think when you detail something and explain specifically what it is, then the public can decide.
NPR certainly has no difficulty calling murder, murder. It doesn't call it enhanced argumentation technique. The terrorists call themselves freedom fighters, but NPR calls acts of terror, right, acts of terror. In other respects, NPR hasn't taken a position against, you know, nouns. Why this one in particular?
I think because it is a hotly debated topic. Isn't that why any news organization is studying it, analyzing it, trying to figure out what's the right thing to do? I get emails from people who say, why doesn't NPR call a doctor who performs abortions a terrorist? Our language in general is totally evaluative and loaded with meaning. And so whatever someone uses, if someone else disagrees with it, then that language is wrong. So embedded in NPR's policy, it does say that we may refer to specific techniques such as waterboarding and note that the president and the attorney general have said that waterboarding is torture. So NPR does not have a never use the word torture in their arsenal.
The rationale was not then unique to NPR, nor is it to this day. After 9/11, as practiced by the CIA, waterboarding and other torture techniques suddenly became a subject too politically explosive to be spoken of by their actual names. I say suddenly because in the previous 70 years, American media had no difficulty whatsoever calling waterboarding torture, perhaps because the cases being reported till then involved foreign savagery. A 2010 study by students at Harvard's Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy documented the usage at four major newspapers over the 20th century and the dramatic shift following the revelations from Abu Ghraib prison in 2003. At the New York Times, for example, from 1931 to 1999, in 81.5% of mentions, waterboarding was called or implied to be torture. From 2002 to 2008, only two of 143 articles about waterboarding, 1.4%, used the T word. At the Los Angeles Times, for roughly the same periods, the torture label was applied 96.3% of the time historically and 4.8% since 2004. And the beat goes on.
For the debate, are drones more humane than enhanced interrogation? We will read your comments on that next.
One, that brutal interrogations produced little, if any, actionable intelligence.
To capture Al-Qaeda suspects, whisk them off to secret sites, and interrogate them with harsh techniques, including waterboarding.
Eric Umansky is assistant managing editor at ProPublica, and he's been cataloging the terminology used by various news organizations this week. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Me, I've seen some directness, some euphemism, and some torturous middle ground. What is the predominant language this week used to describe waterboarding and the rest?
I think there's actually been a real mixed bag. The New York Times, and it's been well talked about, a few months ago made the decision to call torture, torture. And frankly, I think it's aided in the clarity of their coverage. You don't need these extraordinary write-arounds, and you can just call it what it is. Other places have everything from harsh tactics, severe techniques. Some places, and this I find really surprising, frankly, at this late point in the game, refer to enhanced interrogation techniques. That is a bureaucratic euphemism that was created by the government.
And where did you locate that?
I'm sorry. That was on NPR.
Mm-hmm. My favorite, I must say, was in the Wall Street Journal. It described what went on in Abu Ghraib and various secret CIA prisons as rough treatment, which, you know, reminds me of describing a shower rape at Penn State as horsing around. And that wasn't the Rupert Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal. But you don't necessarily discern a partisan tilt in the use of various kinds of euphemisms. You can't necessarily look at the euphemism and predict what paper produced it.
No, that's exactly right. I will say, looking at the Wall Street Journal's coverage, it struck me as somewhat less full-throated than other publications. But generally, I think you're absolutely right that this is not primarily an ideological take. And, you know, clearly there are ideological components to people calling it some things and shying away from the use of torture. But there's also a real strong strain that has nothing to do with ideology, but rather is simply letting an excess of caution get in the way of plain, accurate descriptions.
Is it your sense that the outlets that employ euphemisms in this torturous language are doing it because they feel the word torture might actually not apply, or simply because they feel the word is so politically charged that using it opens them to accusations of bias? Is someone working the refs and are they capitulating?
I suspect that it's the latter. You know, hard to know what's going on deep down in people's thinking around each of these. But I think it would be hard to argue, looked at plainly, some of the techniques that were detailed in the report, and to then look at the definition, the commonly understood meaning of what torture is, and to really have a significant dispute that, you know, putting somebody in a human-sized coffin for a week, right, what that would qualify as. Putting somebody in shackles in a dark room for 17 days, giving people what was, in a euphemistic term, referred to as rectal rehydration. It obviously sounds like an awful term, but also has this kind of medical tint to it when, in fact, there's no medical justification for it. What it was sexual assault and torture.
In the introduction, we referred to a 2010 study done by students at Harvard, which demonstrated unequivocally that until Abu Ghraib, the media had no difficulty calling waterboarding torture. In fact, between 80 and 90% of the time that these large news organizations were writing about the practice, which goes back at least to the beginning of the 20th century, it was labeled torture, full stop. And only in a post-9/11 environment did it suddenly become subject to interpretation. How did that happen?
Torture got turned into a political debate. And when you have terms and language that becomes the subject of a political debate, a number of media institutions and many journalists can essentially get overly concerned about, quote unquote, taking a position. So that once the issue of torture became this debated thing, then calling something what it is became sort of implicitly taking a position somehow in the debate or being seen to take a position in the debate. And, you know, I just think you're doing damage to our job. Our job is to accurately and clearly describe things. And as you point out, and these students pointed out in their study from 2010, absent the political debate, when stripped of that, when you talk about the treatment of people in other countries, it's not at all hard to call something what it is. And I think that's a sort of clarifying exercise.
You detected a strange sort of having it both ways phenomenon, wherein news organizations would use the term for the Senate's investigation, the torture report, either in or out of quotes in headlines, or the so-called torture report, without mentioning the word torture in the body of the story. How prevalent was that solution?
I saw that a few times, and we should understand and acknowledge the fuller context here, which really goes beyond journalists and journalism. The report itself didn't use the word torture, right? They were quite careful about that. Now, the report, as everybody knows, is incredibly damning and has remarkable details. And they didn't use the word not because they were using euphemisms, but because they were trying essentially not to hand further ammunition to potential critics and so forth. But it's all emblematic of, I think, the fact that we as a society have, and polls suggest this too, not really come to a consensus about how we feel about what was done in those CIA dark prisons. And the ambivalence that you see on news pages and you see in stories, I think, is to some degree a reflection of our society's ambivalence overall.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Umansky is assistant managing editor of ProPublica. To update NPR's policy, the network issued guidance offering no hard and fast rules. The word torture has been used by All Things Considered host Robert Siegel and reporter Tom Gelton without attributing it to third parties. According to an August memo reissued this week by Standards and Practices editor Mark Memmott, the guidance on the word torture comes down to, quote, whether it makes sense in the context of the piece. NPR has not replied to our requests for further comment. That's it for this special edition. On the Media is produced by Sara Abdurakhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, Andrew Chug, and Ethan Cheel. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovich. And our show was edited, in this case, by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this episode were Greg Rippon and Andrew Dunn. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Remember to check your podcast feed for the regularly scheduled edition of On the Media, which is Brooks Report from Liberia. There's also a brand new episode of our spin-off podcast, TLDR. I'm Bob Garfield.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.